Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today is December 15th, 2011. We hope that these shows have supported and educated you through many of the legal issues in the United States, and I think that it actually affects things that are happening around the world. And we hope to motivate you to investigate for yourself when your rights have been stepped upon. Okay, and also I would like to tell you that we're going to appreciate any kind of spreading of the word of this show, how you can be part of this educational movement by telling your friends to listen to the show, send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace. You can even copy the embed code for the show and put it on your website and blog, and people can listen directly on your space. You can favorite the show and become a regular listener. Click the reminder button. And I want to tell everyone that this is the last of the Vaccinations and Your Rights show for the year 2011. The next time we get on, it will be January 2012. I would appreciate also if you either contact myself or Alan. You could contact Greg if you like his shows. Send them a comment, ask us a question, and maybe we'll be able to answer it online in future shows. Visit Alan's website, pandemicresponseproject.com, to be filled in on the latest news. Or you can even purchase his awesome e-guide to vaccination exemptions and waivers in the United States. I want to remind you that we're talking about this legal system, which is extremely complex. Each person has questions and situations that must be taken on a case-by-case basis. Especially in the United States, we have 50 states. Each of them have their own regulations regarding legal vaccination exemptions. So thus, we cannot make any blanket statements that fit across the board when we answer questions here. And we also need to realize that everybody has their own personal needs, whether they're dealing with a home situation, a private situation, whether they are in the public, the military, a clinical setting, and we're going to be talking about that specifically today. We can talk to soldiers, veterans, physicians, nurses, medical aides, and even people who are taking care of adoptive children or immigrants who are searching for answers entering the United States. Alan's guide will really be of great assistance and help to get you started. And he really enjoys taking your questions on air or listening to your examples, your true life examples, that we can understand exactly what's going on in the world today. And I want to emphasize that the purpose of this show, to the listening audience, we are here to educate you only. We are not giving legal advice, and that we want you to become aware of your rights. And then the last step of this is your actions. You can have some legislative initiatives that are ongoing, and we'll let you know. I think the NVIC is the place to go for that, NVIC.org, and go ahead, educate yourself, study up, and then maybe you will be able to take some educated action. Lastly, I'm just going to begin the show with Alan. I did a really long intro today with a quote from Winston Churchill, which he said, "All the great things are simple, and many can be expressed in a single word: freedom, justice, honor, duty, mercy, hope." And so even though he listed six words, I think he was implying that the essence of each of those words were simple, and yet they were great, great things for our country and for humanity. And now I'm going to let Alan take us away on the topics of today.
Well, good afternoon, Debbie. Thank you for that detailed introduction. People's rights can and often do vary with the unique circumstances of each person's lives or family's lives, and depending on what jurisdiction you're in with regard to what state you're in, or if you're in a federal context like military or immigration, those are federal jurisdictions. But and often with vaccine religious exemptions in particular, you are dealing with mixtures of state and federal law. So it can be very complicated. In some instances, it really is straightforward. In many states, for example, when you're dealing with school exemptions, you sign a form, check a box, or something like that, and it can be as simple as that. So it's not always complicated, fortunately, but many times it is. And so it's really important to start with an understanding about your rights so that you don't get yourself into a situation that you then have to try to go back and fix after the fact. So even folks who do live in a state where you check a box, it's still good to have information about your rights, because that helps you not only to understand, you may not need a detailed understanding in order to put a check mark in a box, but you may nevertheless have to interact with people, and having a good idea of where the boundaries of your rights are, where the boundaries of the school or doctors or state or what have you, whatever you're dealing with, the boundaries of their rights and obligations. It's really helpful to have some of that basic information. Well, this past week and past few days, Debbie, have been no exception to the months and months of shows we've now done and I've had the great pleasure of doing with you, in that there just continues to be a regular flow of news information on the subject of vaccines and occasionally related issues, that there's just more going on than we can talk about. But we're going to cover some samples today in terms of a sampling of some of the news articles that are posted on the Pandemic Response Project. And I keep that updated usually on a daily basis. Sometimes there'll be a day or two that passes that I don't get it updated for one reason or another, but there is, on the whole, a continually updated flow of important vaccine-related information. And so I hope folks will become informed by our discussions today, but there's even more information and more articles worthy of our attention and awareness continually being updated at the pandemicresponseproject.com. There's a news link at the upper right of every page on that site. Take you straight to the news page.
Yeah, we can't cover it all in one hour. So we're just going to give you some highlights and then go into depth. Give us our personal opinion about things and then get you thinking, right?
Hopefully so.
Okay, so let's get us started today.
Sure. Boy, I tell you, and Debbie and I always try to get a sense ahead of time, of course, to be organized, what we want to talk about, and then there's almost always, or at least frequently, something that comes up at the last minute. And what I want to start with today is something that just came to my attention yesterday. An article that's on the AAPS website, that's the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And I want to take just a brief moment here to really underscore what a wonderfully unique organization this is, in the sense that it is an organization that has doctors and surgeons around the U.S. who are members, thousands of members, and they are I think they stand alone as a medical or primarily medical doctor organization, as far as I know. I'd be happy to be wrong about this, but I believe they stand alone pretty much in their historically and recent willingness to speak truth, even if it seems to contradict the mainstream views, they with vaccines in particular, of course, but I think some other issues as well. But the director of the AAPS, the executive director, Dr. Jane Orient, just recently posted on the AAPS website a letter to Colorado public health officials concerning mandatory flu vaccines for healthcare workers. And that's a topic we've talked about recently, but it's something that I'm seeing a lot of in my practice over the last several weeks and currently as we speak, because as I've mentioned in the past, since the so-called pandemic a couple of years ago, the last flu season and again this year, we're seeing this national trend in hospitals and other healthcare facilities, after years of only recommending flu shots for their employees, many of these hospitals are now mandating flu shots for their employees on a get the shot or be terminated kind of basis. And my impression is what I'm seeing from the sampling that I see of what's going on around the country in terms of workers from around the country calling me and saying, how do I avoid this legally? I'm seeing a variety of different specific policies, you know, it varies from hospital to hospital, but what I'm seeing on the whole is a national trend. It seems to really be sweeping the country and moving quickly, and only a couple of times have I heard of hospitals who considered this and opted not to mandate flu shots. So this is a real switch, and we have historically had fewer than half of healthcare workers choosing to get the vaccine. Of course, when it's mandatory, they're going to have 90, 95, 98% or more, depending on how rigid the policy is in any given institution. They're going to double or triple their market coverage in this particular segment of the population. And I don't have numbers, but it's a significant one. In terms of the numbers, we've got many, many hospitals and healthcare workers. It's not just the nurses and doctors. I've had people who were doctors or nurses as clients, but I've also had people who were technicians who work in a whole different building and don't even ever see patients and maybe work with computers. Or I had one client who was a hospital cook. Everybody is being required to get the flu shot who's connected with a hospital or other healthcare facility. So
are these mandatory influenza shots, has that changed in what the requirements are? Because you're kind of saying everyone who works in the facility or enters the facility is now required. Is that has the regulations for hospital workers and nurses, physicians, and even people in the data off the financial offices who are working in the hospitals, has that changed?
Well, and that's a really good question because it raises an important distinction, because there's a lot of confusion in this arena about where the mandates are coming from. Primarily, the mandates are coming from the hospitals as a matter of hospital policy, as opposed to, for example, in the school environment, we see state laws, state statutes and state regulations spelling out the requirements and procedures for vaccine requirements, but then also the exemption and waiver procedures and so forth. Primarily, this concerns the vaccines in the hospital setting are coming from the companies and not from the state. But
meaning that the hospital, the headquarters of the hospital, that the administration could actually say this is not mandatory.
Yes, they have the option to decide whether or not to make it mandatory. Now, a couple of people have talked to me about a national accrediting agency, an agency that certifies hospitals as meeting certain standards in order to be accredited. and that the requirement is coming from the accreditation level. And this is an interesting piece of information in that a single accrediting agency may be responsible for mandates being implemented in hospitals in a majority of states. And this is an area that I need to do more research on. I don't have the details yet, but it appears to me that it's a very centralized decision for probably a majority of hospitals in the country, as opposed to somebody, say, in a pharmaceutical company directly somehow trying to apply pressure to individual hospitals one at a time around the country. So, I mean, this goes to a more basic principle of where I think there are flaws in the current structure of our society that shows up in the form of serious problems with vaccine policy and law, and that is the extent to which power and decisions are centralized is this extent to which there is more potential for misuse and abuse of power and more adverse effects hitting more people from the misuse or abuse of that power. So I'm a strong advocate of decentralization as a general principle. There may be certain issues where centralization is preferable or even necessary, but on the whole, the more decentralized decision-making authority is, the less ability there is for a smaller number of people to take advantage of and misuse or abuse power in affecting larger numbers of people at a time. And
okay,
I think
let's,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, let's just jump in now to the letter and
yes.
Take a close look at what is being said.
So it looks like that the Colorado public health officials now are looking at mandating the vaccine. And there are some state laws mandating vaccines for healthcare workers, and there are a few states that have exemptions. But mostly what is happening around the country at this point in time is at the hospital policy level and not a state law level. But I think we're going to see a push around the country for states to enact laws, you know, mandating it. There'll be more pressure, perhaps in that way, or more consistent policies than perhaps around the country if they're based on statutory or regulatory requirements. But in any case, the executive director of the AAPS is opposing this, and she asks in her letter that was posted yesterday. First of all, she points out that fewer than half of American healthcare workers choose to be immunized annually against the flu. And this is a really important point, and it's so disturbing to me because I hear over and over and over again, in fact, without exception, when I hear from the many different healthcare workers from around the country that I've heard from, everyone that talks to me and says, asks me, how do I avoid the vaccine, tells me that there are others that they work with who also don't want the vaccine, but they're afraid to even say anything or apply for an exemption because they feel that that will they'll be perceived as rocking the boat or making waves.
They'll be jeopardizing their job if they, you know, make waves.
Yep. And so, I hear this over and over again from all parts of the country. I get the impression, and my clients support my perceptions, that this is the healthcare work environment is very militant, very rigid. Yeah, restrictive. That there's really no room for offering your own unique ideas or opinions. Or
what we would call freedom of choice in the healthcare environment.
No freedom of speech. Yeah.
I'm gonna mention that freedom of speech thing too today. So the proposed Colorado policy requires that facilities inform their workers of the benefits and the risks of influenza immunization. And what the name of the author here is
Dr. Jane Orient,
right? And she is on the Response Project Professional Panel.
Yep.
What she says is This is very global a statement. It does not specify what the requirements are or what the benefits and risks are. What is she targeting here?
Well, I tell you, we see this come up. I've seen this over and over again in different environments. You know, even pediatricians are required to get what's called a VIS, a vaccine information statement, to parents before they give the shot, as if that form. I mean, it's sort of a contradiction in one sense. I mean, yes, we should inform people about the benefits and risks, but if they have to get the shot anyway, what's the point in giving them that, first of all? But second of all, we always see every one of these that I've seen never gives an objective view of the vaccine. They give the one-sided pro-vaccine opinion, and every time, and this is so disturbing.
In other words, they usually say, this nurse or whoever is coming in to bring you your vaccine today. Do they ever verbally, orally say to you, what is your, check mark this box? You have a choice. You can say, yes, I am taking it today, or you can say, no, I am not taking it today. So basically, in most of the language, the body language, the environment, the language, even though they might hand you a piece of paper that has stuff that you're not going to read, they're not really presenting it to you as an open-ended question.
Well, no, they're saying here's the requirement, and it's sort of like they're fulfilling. But honestly, I think in a disingenuous way, some sort of obligatory, it's a gesture suggestive of informed choice, and yet they're probably not going to be informed of any exemption or waiver rights they may have. Now, I know at a state level,
right. That
may or may not be true, but I've only seen a couple of state laws, for example, as it pertains to school exemptions, where the law requires the state to inform you of the exemption.
I see.
I think I understand why that's the case. I don't agree with it, but I understand why that's the case, because from a perspective of public policy, under mainstream views of vaccines, you don't want to do anything to encourage the exercise of exemptions. You put whatever
right.
laws
they're
you put
trying to
there.
Get you to comply. They're trying to get you to comply. So by giving you another option and out, that would kind of leave you in the decision-making role. I don't know.
But, we've talked on this show, repeatedly, I'm sure, about some of the evidence that suggests strongly that flu vaccines have little or no effectiveness, and that they, and we've underscored, as Dr. Orient does in her letter, that vaccines come with a risk of death or long-term disability or other kinds of adverse effects-related experiences, and you don't see people, states or companies presenting an objective view of the information. You don't see them pointing out, for example, that 90 to 95% of vaccine adverse events, according to the FDA and CDC, are never even reported. I've had one of my clients at who works at a hospital recently tell me, they've already had one person at the hospital who came down with this Guillain-Barré syndrome, and, the one doctor is denying that it has anything to do with the vaccine, and she had just been vaccinated, although her neurologist thinks it is related to the vaccine. So what we see in the reports I hear consistently are that when there is something that happens right after a vaccine, the immediate knee-jerk reaction of most doctors is, it's coincidental, it's not related. But they make that assessment off the top of their head. They don't base that on some kind of investigative study. Nobody does any tests or assessment of the person.
It's up to the person to fight that battle, really, to get to the adverse effects, and because they could possibly be sued or get care to pay for their infirmity. Hey, so let's read exactly what Dr. Jane Orient says. She says, what is the purpose of this information if workers are not allowed to make a decision based upon it? What provisions are made for indemnifying workers who experience an adverse effect, some of which can lead to death, hospitalization, or long-term disability. In the age of evidence-based medicine, it is shocking that there is so little evidence that the influenza vaccination program is effective. And for me, it seems like they're talking from one side of their mouth when they say, let's give informed consent. And then they don't, well, by using the term evidence-based medicine, and they don't use evidence-based medicine, especially when we're talking about homeopathy, you know, they're always asking for that, but they really don't have the evidence themselves to promote this type of medication.
Well, and there's, well, there is some evidence. There are studies that show some support for flu vaccines. There are also studies that contradict that. But what I hear over and over again from the medical folks who dig beneath the surface into this is that when you look at studies that have conclusions that favor vaccines, you often find flaws in the study. And Dr. Orient refers to the Cochrane Collaboration here, which is a nonprofit organization that has done a few, if not several, different reviews of the flu vaccine literature and never come up with something that was particularly supportive in any strong way whatsoever of the vaccine. To the contrary, they come up with conclusions that the flu vaccine has little or no effectiveness. And one of the studies, one of the more recent ones that I'm aware of, was about a year ago, of the flu literature for healthy adults, concluded that there was evidence, widespread evidence of manipulation of conclusions. Not the only person or organization to raise serious concerns about the medical literature and the way that that universe operates. Collectively, people who have spoken out recently have raised some very serious concerns about the reliability or lack thereof of the medical literature in general. But this, the Cochrane Collaboration, among the many things that it's done in doing reviews of the flu vaccine literature, have come up with conclusions that there are, bottom line, serious problems with the way that medical literature is, the way that there's probably a better word than universe here, but the way that that little universe operates. There apparently are people who will manipulate studies for whatever reason, to further their own careers or in support of pharmaceutical industry or whatever the motivation is. The bottom line is we have something that for decades, if not longer, has been the reference point for what is truth in science and medicine. And now increasingly we come to learn that it's not reliable at all for that. Does that mean that all studies are not reliable? No, it means we increasingly have difficulty knowing which studies we can or can't rely on.
Alan,
yes.
There's a couple, you're not on the live chat today, but there's quite a few people there and a couple of comments I'd like to remark upon.
Sure.
One of them is talking about there were, up to this date, in this flu season, which usually starts the end of August, September, October, there have been a total of 13 influenza cases in the entire United States. And that the companies want 200 million doses of vaccines to be sold. And I put up on the chat the link to the CDC.gov flu weekly report, where you can take a look at the actual numbers showing that there were 143 type A that were concluded, that were subtyping not performed. And for 2009, it says, that in the nation, that is, not really 2012, this says 2009 influenza H1N1A, there were 13. And it breaks it down, there were zero pediatric deaths reported. And I think if I scroll down a little bit further, it might say something about 2012. Okay. Influenza positive tests reported to the CDC by U.S. WHO NREVSS, Collaborating Laboratories, the national summary. And you can see there in the bar chart that the number has precipitously dropped in half. And, you know, we also have to rely on the testing that, you know, people come in and say they have the flu, and yet until they're actually tested to determine what the cause of illness is, we don't know. I also wanted to talk a little bit further about what you said regarding the kinds of outcomes that can happen from a vaccination, these adverse effects, and what Dr. Jane Orient has said. She said that she gives a link, and I'll give that link onto the chat. It's a PDF file showing that the evidence for this is ineffective and that safety data are reported in very few studies. Only five randomized studies with 2,963 observations extending only 1 week after the injection. So you have to think that people really could have after effects long term, not just 1 week. It could be weeks, months, and even years into the future when the cumulative damage of all of these adjuvants and ingredients will take effect. And I want to go ahead. Do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I just wanted one real quick comment. This is been in regular practice for some time in the pharmaceutical industry. I used to live across the street from a couple who both had been nurses at Duke Medical Center for, something on the order of 25 years or so at the time that I met them. And the husband had occasion to be involved in one way or another with research conducted at Duke University by or on behalf of pharmaceutical companies, and talked about how it was a practice that the pharmaceutical companies will sometimes do their own preliminary studies first, and they'll look at where the adverse events show up. And if the adverse events show up, for example, 3 weeks after the administration of the drug, they will then commission a study to be done that will look for 2 weeks after the administration of the drug to see what happens. And, of course, that will show no adverse effects. To say that you're only looking 1 week after a vaccine is just kind of absurd at this point in time, where we know that adverse effects can show up anywhere from seconds to decades. It really doesn't make sense to look for any shorter period than at least a period of a few months. We just had, I think we discussed this on a recent show as well, Washington, D.C. Federal Circuit Court, the Clower case, where she had some symptoms show up intermittently over a period of 3 or 4 or 5 years, and it wasn't until 4 or 5 years later that she had the onset. This was from a hepatitis B vaccine, but that Dr. Clower had the onset of serious and persistent symptoms that ultimately resulted in a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. But this was something that took a long time after the administration of the vaccine to fully set in and fully show up. And so this idea that you can look for a week and be done with it is
right. And that show is, I think, two shows back. The last show we had was with Greg, and then I think it was the previous show or the show before that we discussed that particular case.
Right. So the 1 week is. It doesn't even strike me that looking for just a week as a level of sort of carelessness on the part of a researcher. You really have to assume that the researchers are know more about it than that. And I mean, it really, the sniff test suggests much more strongly that this was a deliberate way to avoid measuring or finding or seeing any adverse reactions than somebody who just didn't know better.
Okay, and let's continue with the reading here. It says, in fact, the coordinator of the vaccine section of the Cochrane Collaboration called for an urgent reevaluation of the UK's influenza vaccination program and it says Jefferson T. Influenza Vaccination Policy versus Evidence, and it gives a link to the BMJ, British Medical Journal. In particular, she says, the safety of many repeated similar vaccinations is not addressed. And then she goes on to list allergic, anaphylactic, hyperimmune, and disimmune reactions are possible. And for myself, I went ahead and wanted to know, what do these terms mean? Because these things could be listed on a handout, a disclosure form, and you might read it and gloss over it and say, sure, I know what an allergic reaction is. Yeah, I'm not an allergic type of person. Or you could read anaphylactic, hyperimmune, and disimmune and not really know what they are talking about. So when you talk about an allergic reaction, you're talking about having a high concentration of antibodies produced in reaction to repeated injections of an antigen. This is actually the definition for the hyperimmune, and having a greater than normal immunity because of an unusual abundance of antibodies. And here on the chat, Victor has said that earlier he wrote someplace here that children are required to get so many, what, American infants receive 60-plus doses of vaccinations. And that doesn't leave the body. Those ingredients have a buildup, a cumulative effect. And we're going to go on to understand a little bit more about where those ingredients seem to accumulate in the body. The hyperimmune egg, for instance, is an egg from a hen that has been vaccinated against certain infectious diseases. The hen develops specific antibodies that rev up the immune system to fight the specific diseases included in the vaccination. This is similar to what, you know, when we do give a person a vaccination. These antibodies pass into the hen's eggs. People harvest the eggs and remove the antibodies. These antibodies are then used to treat diseases in people. And people don't realize exactly how the vaccinations are produced. This kind of explains it a little bit. Hyperimmune eggs are used to treat diarrhea caused by rotavirus, infectious diarrhea, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, and high cholesterol. It is also used to for a general stimulation of the immune system. You want me to go on? Isn't it interesting? I mean, well, this is something people need to know.
It is. I was just talking with on another show last night. We were talking about how many doctors know how little.
A vaccine is produced and what's in it.
And what's in it, exactly. You know, the host was talking about how a nurse who had been promoting vaccines in her job for 20-something years, and he said, well, do you actually know what's in a vaccine? And got no response. People blindly accept and believe what they've been told, and I don't fault people for doing that, because the way that we have been educated has, I think, in large part, intentionally been designed in a way to create unquestioning, compliant, I don't know what other word to put in there to describe it, but people who are educated and believe a particular point of view, and it makes sense, it's presented in a way that it makes sense, and so anybody who says anything different is obviously ignorant, because what I believe makes sense. And they'll just kind of get with the program automatically without questioning it for years and years and years. And then you could hit them with what seems on its face a really simple and obvious question that they never bothered to ask themselves, because they had never had anything happen or occur that caused them to question
or
challenge
their beliefs. And if they knew, they would run the other way.
Well, potentially. At the very least, we hope learning what's in vaccines would open the door. I mean, I'll give a quick example. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, she's, in my opinion, probably one of the most well-informed doctors on the planet. She has spent, on the vaccine issue, she has spent countless hours researching and reading and evaluating the medical literature on vaccines. She was initially, as most doctors are, pro-vaccine. And she says, based on her medical school education, that she thought vaccines contained probably just the antigen, the modified bacterial or viral components, and maybe some saline or something. She had no idea there was this long list of ingredients. Doctors are not taught this in their medical education. Nursing mm-hmm. students are not taught this in their nursing education. They are given selective information that creates a portrait of something that is unquestionable, and
right,
therefore
so
they unquestionably support it.
Half of the information is not full disclosure. So let's find out a little bit more about these eggs. Because, you know, a lot of people are today hyper-allergic to many things. That people have celiac disease, they're allergic to gluten, they're allergic to all dairy products, and they're allergic to eggs. And this is what's in the vaccine. So how does it work? The antibodies contained in these hyperimmune eggs are thought to stimulate the immune system and help the body fight disease. Most of the research on hyperimmune eggs come from the manufacturer of a specific brand name product called Immune 26, Legacy for Life. This and related products contain the proprietary ingredient egg cell, which is a specific hyperimmune egg extract. According to product information, this product is produced first by repeatedly immunizing hens with at least 24 inactivated bacteria, including Shigella dysenteria, Staphylococcus epidermidis, and simulans, E. coli, Salmonella, Typhimurium, Pseudomonas, Klebsiella, Haemophilus, influenza, and at least 6 species of Streptococcus. Oh boy. Now, this is even news for me. What's going on with these little eggs?
Well, all I have to say is poor hens, but go ahead.
Yeah, so hyperimmune eggs or immune eggs are laid by hens that typically have been stimulated multiple times by all of these microorganisms or purified antigens. The preparation may contain different species of strains or organisms, which I just listed. These stimulates the hens to produce eggs that contain the immunoglobulins antibodies of many classes, with the dominant class being the unique avian IgY class. Upon ingestion, much of the immunoglobulin is apparently still able to bind antigen despite exposure to digestive enzymes. This means that it's going to go into the human system when we eat these eggs. Boy, I don't think I'm going to eat any more eggs.
Only organic eggs.
And even our own acids are not going to affect it. Along with the production of antibodies, stimulation of the hens results in generation of small molecules that appear to have pro- and anti-inflammatory properties, and that they have a reference for that. By up or down regulating immunological responses, especially those of an autoimmune or inflammatory nature, these factors appear to help the body initiate defenses against pathogens, mutating cells, and help maintain immune homeostasis. Now, I have a question about all this. I mean, if we are creating hyperimmune chicks with hyperimmune eggs, and we're constantly eating how many eggs a week, and we're getting these kinds of nanoparticles, small molecules in us that's supposedly going to affect the inflammatory system, which is part of all disease, and we're creating an overabundance of antigens, we are now making humans hypersensitive. At least that's my thinking. I may not be a scientist. I may not be logical. I don't know. But that is what's sort of coming to mind, that we, just in the way that we're doing treating these hens, we're actually doing it to ourselves.
Well, part of the problem with any non-natural additives to food or water, for example, fluoride or other things that in whatever amounts, trace or otherwise, in water, is there's no way to control the amount that any given individual consumes or the rate of consumption for any individual. And even if and complicating that even more is the fact that individuals vary in their ability to tolerate or eliminate toxins in their manner that individual bodies will respond to non-natural substances, well, even some natural substances as well. But when you get into food and water contaminants, it's just something that is virtually uncontrollable. And so there's a huge, huge question and problem there, on that level, just because of that. But I'd like to – let's see if we can
I have a whole bunch of discussion here. I have so much more to say. Maybe I should do another show all by myself. We only have 15 minutes left or less.
I know. I wanted to at least touch on some of the other news articles to let people know the kinds of things that are going on and the kinds of things they can get from the Pandemic Response Project news page. But this is all critical information that we need to know. I mean, how many things are there that we're putting into our bodies on a regular basis that we really don't know what we're putting into our bodies? And, you've raised very important questions here with regard to immunity. And, of course, there's been exploration about alternative means of generating immunity through different kinds of vaccines. You know, conventionally, that's always been with a shot in the arm or somewhere, but we have in more recent years some nasal spray vaccines, but vaccines have been explored in terms of research, even the use of mosquitoes to pass along vaccines or vaccines in various foods.
There's
been research about that. And the spray one is kind of curious because somebody gets a virus sprayed up their nose and then anybody they breathe on or sneeze on or touch, they may rub their nose and then shake hands with somebody and so forth. I mean, you can spread that around potentially quite easily. I mean, from the point of view...
And these things might be happening already, right?
Oh, yes, because we have, people using nasal vaccines. And so just because you choose not to vaccinate doesn't mean that you're not getting vaccinated. That's, I guess, my point. And I think that becomes the more that we explore and begin to implement as a society... variations in alternative means of administering vaccines, such as through nasal sprays or food or other ways that they can test these things out when they find ways that work, the more, at least in some instances, that opens the door to people being vaccinated, whether they know it or not, whether they want it or not. So that's kind of a curious and potentially serious issue there. But let's come back and elaborate on these sort of things more because it is important to understand have a basic understanding of how vaccines are supposed to work, how they actually work or not. And there's a lot of conflicting information out there about what vaccines actually do, whether they're actually effective, and whether the underlying theory is really sound or flawed. And these are all topics worthy of our individual exploration and understanding.
People can go back and listen to the dozens and dozens of shows that we have done on that issue.
Well, let me take, if I may, Debbie, just in the last few minutes here, without getting into depth, I wanted to just sort of touch on briefly some of the different articles here. There was an article, the title of which is, and this comes from Gaia Health. It's GAIA -health.com. They have an article, Flu Vaccine Damages Children's Immune System, Is the Risk of Cancer Increased? And the author in this study, in this article, refers to studies that show that the type A influenza vaccine, while it may offer little or no benefit, it actually weakens the immune system in children with regard to other influenza viruses. As we've discussed on the show before, there are different strains of influenza that, and among the many different strains, different ones may be the dominant strain or strains each season. When and presumably one of the reasons we get a flu shot every year rather than just once or a short series and you're immune for, you know, years to come, as supposedly occurs with other vaccines, is that the dominant strain will vary from year to year. And so they have to predict in advance what's going to be the dominant strain. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. If you get vaccinated for one strain and another strain that wasn't addressed in the vaccine is the dominant strain, even if flu vaccines work, which is a separate question, it may be worthless to you. Well, here's a study that shows that the vaccine for a particular strain actually weakens the body's ability to deal with other strains. Not only that, it suppresses the part of the immune system that helps us that helps us fight off cancer. Many people are not aware that as just a regular course of the way that the body and system, physiology system works, is that we have cancer cells in our body all the time. They're just usually in very minute quantities, and the body's immune system takes care of that.
The author and the owner of Gaia Health is Heidi Stevenson. She's a member of Homeopathy World Community. If you want, we could set up a talk with her if people are interested in that, because she is constantly putting up provocative and alternative views about vaccines and the health issues.
Yes, let's get Heidi on. That would be wonderful. Let's see if we can get her on first part of the year. She would be a terrific. She's done amazing independent research and writing. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. She would be an excellent person to have on, and I would be delighted to have her bring some clarification to us on some of these issues, because I do get outside of my own area of expertise when I get outside of the legal technicalities. There is another article coming from The Hindu, which is in India, and I have information come to me from around the world. I'm delighted to have that kind of global perspective, but I'm sure you have a lot of members of Homeopathy World Community from India, so delighted. Hopefully some are listening today or listening to this on a podcast. The title of this article, Pentavalent Vaccine to be Introduced on Wednesday. Pentavalent meaning that it covers five different diseases, diphtheria, pertussis, hepatitis B, and Haemophilus influenza, or HIB, disease, to replace vaccines that either getting the vaccines separately or maybe that weren't even covering all these different diseases. The difficulty here is that there have been reports of deaths following the administration of this vaccine, and investigations concluded that the deaths were unrelated to the vaccine, so they're going forward with the release and administration of this vaccine in a couple of Indian states. I'm concerned about that because we've seen evidence over and over again of misinformation, downplaying, or denial of genuine vaccine adverse events, and the claim of lack of connection not based on any true scientific investigation of whether or not there is a connection. I don't have specific information about that with regard to this particular situation. But I am concerned every time I hear someone say, oh, the deaths are not related, or the adverse events are not related to the vaccine, when there is a clear temporal connection, because I wonder, you know, what is the science or absence of science supporting those kinds of claims. But there's an article there that people could look at on the pandemicresponseproject.com. Another article referring to the Novartis pandemic flu vaccine manufacturing plant that we've discussed in months past on this show in Holly Springs, North Carolina, right here in our backyard, Debbie's and mine, that was built with the support of some $400 million or more in funding from the federal government. The facilities were, I think, in total over $1 billion facility. The very recent report this month, just a few days ago, saying that that facility is now up and running. In fact, they've already done some, produced two lots of quote-unquote pandemic H5N1 flu vaccine for the Strategic National Stockpile. So they're already up and running there, even though there's not a pandemic that they are specifically building, manufacturing vaccines for. So just let people know that that's one of the many different aspects of the pharmaceutical pro-vaccine agenda that is moving forward. Another article comes to us from Dr. Merrill Nass, a medical doctor who is an expert on the anthrax vaccine issues, but has increasingly in recent years broadened out to address vaccines beyond anthrax. And she points out that pharmaceutical company SIGA is selling the government somewhere between roughly $400 million and $2.8 billion worth of a drug that was developed with government money to treat smallpox. Now, you gotta look at this, and she refers to what she calls a sweetheart deal for SIGA and also other pharmaceutical companies. The government pays for the development of this and then turns around and buys the product that it paid the company to develop. And then, of course, and this happens with vaccines, by the way, of course, and when it happens with vaccines, you have the added element that the government also grants immunity to them for the adverse effects of their product. I mean, who could ask for a better deal? You know, pay me to develop this, then buy what I develop from me, and then enact laws that make me immune from any harm that my products cause. I mean, I think the phrase sweetheart deal is sort of an understatement there. But Dr. Nass elaborates on this a little bit, and I encourage folks to take a look at that article. I know we're running really close here in terms of our time. I'll just mention very briefly an article from The Canadian, but The Canadian has gotten information from Mercola.com, and you can get this information from either source, if not others as well. Dr. Mercola recently had an article where he just points out how drug companies rig the medication studies, as he puts it. Statistics are manipulated, conclusions manipulated. Unfortunately, this is probably far more the norm than the exception at this point in time with the way that the industry works. Very disturbing news, but Dr. Mercola and The Canadian both provide some details on that, and I encourage folks to look at that. Debbie, okay. I think we're about out of time here.
Yeah, we are. I'm going to say goodbye. We're going to close out today. It was awesome. Let's keep up the momentum for in 2012. I want to wish everyone a wonderful end of year, good wishes, good health, and we'll see you the next time. Thanks, Alan.
Thank Take care, you for Debbie. Listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Light your inner candle and never guard.